Well, hey, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. What are you seeing when you look outside? Sunshine? Rain? Snow? Well, I think it's all good, especially getting some moisture for our mountains and valleys. You are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGBM Bozeman Community Radio, 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. I'm your host, Roxana, and today I have Ken Lane's newest episode for you. From April 3rd, 2026, here is Artemis, Pyramids, Tatooine, and Death Valley.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert when the mystery returns. 25 centuries ago in 460 BC, the Greek historian Herodotus describes a great tower in Babylon within the city's sacred enclosure. This may have been the ziggurat that the poets and writers of the book of Genesis called the Tower of Babel, or Babylon. Its eighth level at the top has a fine silken bed beside a great golden table. Herodotus is told by the local priests that a Chaldean woman is chosen to occupy the bed. And she alone sleeps aside the table of gold at the top of the tower, awaiting the nocturnal visit of God. The God who visits in the night. Herodotus says he doesn't believe that last part. But then he mentions that while visiting Egypt, where he also interviewed many priests of the ancient religion, he learned that there, too, certain women are chosen to sleep in the sacred chamber atop the Temple of Amon at Thebes. We may think we are very far away from the time of Herodotus, from the time of ancient Babylon, from the time of God visiting a maiden, from the time of human-born gods such as Dionysus, Heracles, Krishna, Horus. Yet on this Easter weekend, much of the world celebrates the Son of God born to a mortal woman. We still live in the time of gods. At this very moment, in memory of a mission named for the god Apollo, astronauts of the Artemis mission are aboard the Orion spaceship headed for La Luna. The mission is named for Blessed Artemis, goddess of the night, of the hunt, of the moon, daughter of Zeus. What is an astronaut? We get the word from Jason and the Argonauts. The Argonauts being the sailors on the great ship Argo with the goddess Athena on the prow. Odysseus had a dog named Argo too. Now the sailors, the nauts that come after Argo and Argonauts, they share their job's name with the sea, with the nautical, all named for mighty Nautilus, the Titan of the depths. When we first took to the stars, we named our voyagers astronauts, star sailors. Happy Easter to you all. I was looking at the spot price for gold, for an ounce of gold, and at the close of trading on Friday, it was $4,693.90 US dollars, up 3.66% for the week. Gold is the sacred metal of the gods. The temples of ancient Babylon, ancient Egypt, temples and pyramids of Egypt, they were topped in gold. We've all seen an iron horseshoe hanging outside a farmhouse or a barn. For good luck, people say, but it's for more than good luck, it's to keep bad spirits out. Such as the fairies of Celtic folklore and the demons of so many cultures. Maybe because the Iron Age ended the time of the natural people. From back in the Golden Age, iron makes a spirit powerless. It's why cemeteries have wrought iron fencing to keep the spirits of the dead contained within the graveyard. It's why knives are so often buried under the threshold of a new building. Hobgoblins, pixies, old Puck, and the rest, keep out. Gold is different. It's the opposite. We've cherished it forever. You can't make swords or plowshares from gold, yet from the beginning, we've cherished gold as the sacred metal. Ancient priests wore plates of gold. The grandest altars were painted in the stuff. Vows made on golden rings. And it was especially used for decorating the tops of ziggurats. For covering the capstones atop the Great Pyramids. Because gold attracts the divine. The very top of the Giza Pyramids, what's called the Pyramidion, was a crystal coated with a mix of gold and silver. For the gods' golden skin and bones, or blood, of silver. The Incas referred to gold as the sacred perspiration of the sun, and they knew it possessed divine energy. Their temples were adorned with massive quantities of gold to honor Inti, their sun god. The metal's presence was thought to create a direct connection between the earthly and divine realms. There were solid electrum tips to reflect the sun's rays. Electrum is a mix of gold and silver. The great American paranormal folklorist John Keel noted that gold is both an excellent conductor of electricity and an especially dense element. Maybe solid enough for God to sit upon. Because otherwise, the gods pass right through like ghosts, like the entities in so many UFO abduction stories. In ancient Egypt, gold was called the flesh of the gods. And from Buddhist temples to grand cathedrals to the capstones of the Egyptian pyramids, a coating of gold up top is absolutely essential. Why build a pyramid? The pyramids were the simplest way, using blocks of stone or mud brick, to replicate a holy mountain, one of the high places where people have always worshipped. Because it's closer to the sky and closer to the gods. Now add the golden ornamentation. The capstone, painted in gold leaf, are a gold-silver mix, and these are invitations to the angels, a welcome to the entities, an invocation of the gods. To communicate across the sky, our cell phones have gold inside them too. Are we welcoming the angels? Welcoming the entities? Are we welcoming the gods with our golden phones?
Do
Desert Oracle Radio.
Speaking of Voyagers, our Voyager space probes are still sending back data to the Jet Propulsion Lab at Caltech in Pasadena. I mentioned this last week. And those signals are still being picked up through the Deep Space Telescope just south of Death Valley National Park. The antenna base and the remote settlement called Mars. Don't try to go there. Not without an official invitation. Death Valley looks like Mars out there, too. It also looks like the Star Wars planet Tatooine. Because Death Valley was the real-life filming location for the desert planet. And both the original Star Wars from 1977 and the second sequel called Return of the Jedi, shot a couple of years later. I tell that whole story in the first issue of the Desert Oracle Field Guide, number one. The movie also made use of desert landscapes in the Tunisian desert, but many key scenes were done in Death Valley. Children from Death Valley Elementary School served as the little Jawa scavengers. Imagine that. It's early in the year 1977 and you're a kid in school in Death Valley. Your parents work for the national park. Nobody knows about Star Wars because it won't hit theaters for months. But the movie's almost done and they need some pickup shots. And Death Valley will work fine. They need the garbage can robot R2-D2 to wheel through a canyon. They need to film that hovercraft, the prop land speeder, which is actually built over a VW bug frame. A Volkswagen frame towed by a station wagon. They put these mirrored panels on the sides of the Volkswagen to reflect the golden sand and sky, so it looks like it's hovering. But mostly they need a bunch of little people, children, to wear the Jawa robes and hoods and the dark mask with the golden eyes to scurry around the robot they've just disabled so they can steal it and sell it back to the rubes. So these movie people from Los Angeles come into the classroom and they say, if you want to skip school and be in a movie and wear a crazy costume, come with us. It's all approved by the government. There are National Park Service and California Highway Patrol official records of the whole thing. And then Star Wars comes out and your parents take you to see it in the city 2 hours away in Las Vegas. Maybe they drove to LA, who knows? But it's the biggest thing in the world. And you're a kid. And you're in the Star Wars movie. Plus you skip school with permission. Later that same summer, Elvis Presley dies. And your parents are sad. Dear friends of Desert Oracle, for the first time in years, there will be live campfire stories in Joshua Tree under the stars. We're aiming for 3 sunset to darkness shows. We'll see how the demand is. They'll be recorded for broadcast. We're trying to get video for them, too. We're pivoting to video, you know. And we're still fighting with the ticketing system, but if you're a patron of this program, you'll see the link up top on the Patreon page in the day or two ahead, maybe even tonight, if I can get it fixed. And once the patrons get a chance to get their tickets, I'll open it up to everybody. We're talking about May 2026 for these events, all on Saturday nights in the desert just behind the Joshua Tree Retreat Center. And I'll have some more news in the days to come. But it's May 2, May 16, and what's the other day? May 23, May 23rd. But I sent out an announcement on the Patreon the other day. 30, 35 seconds later, I get three or four angry emails. Someone's like, oh, you put the wrong number here. No, this does, I clicked and this. Good God. Give me a minute. Let me post the thing and look at it and I'll make sure it's all right. Don't worry, it'll be fixed real soon. You don't need such trigger fingers on the phone, on the internet, you know? Take a walk. Get some fresh air. It has been tough to get these campfire shows to happen again compared to the easy days of old when we did monthly campfire stories at the old Ace Hotel in Palm Springs. We did those for 3 years straight. But those days are long gone, so I'm making these the last such Desert Oracle shows, the last of our outdoor campfire scary story nights in the desert under the stars. There's a possibility I'll do one more at a festival being planned for later in the year, but that'll be part of a festival, sort of out of my hands. Maybe it happens, and maybe not, which is the usual result of almost anything you spend weeks and months working on, sometimes years. It just doesn't happen. So if you want to come see the good old-fashioned Desert Oracle campfire stories with my good friend Herb Benham IV playing classic cowboy campfire songs to get us going, it's good to say goodbye to stuff. Can't keep doing the same thing, my God. I have been doing these for more than a decade now. And I've been lucky to do them. Thank you to all of you who have come out and enjoyed them. That's about the best way to do a show under the stars. This is Desert Oracle Radio. With some classic soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver tonight. And some other stuff, too. I was talking with my buddy Dave at the bar by the airstrip, and somehow we got on the subject of Sir Francis Drake and the replica of his famous ship, the Golden Hind. A replica of which had come through the Golden Gate to San Francisco a couple of decades back. And we needed another round. Although our water glasses were full, so I said water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. That's from Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the great romantic poet, from England's West Country, same as Drake. Coleridge completed and first published his Rime of the Ancient Mariner in 1798. And this publication begins the romantic movement, really, because the poem first appeared in the poetry book that Coleridge and his dear friend William Wordsworth published together that year. the end of the 18th century. Lyrical ballads, it was called. Good, clear description. Not like books today, which generally have some gibberish title and sounds like an AI translation of something originally in Brazilian Portuguese. The mounds of our trauma, like windmills for the supervisor. Anyway, here's where the Coleridge line comes from. Water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. The very deep did rot, O Christ, that ever this should be. Yea, slimy things did crawl with legs upon the slimy sea. There's some Lovecraft in Coleridge, or vice versa on the correct timeline. The only one we know that moves forward. Who knows which way time goes? Only the great old ones just barely breathing in deep slumber, deep beneath the deep salt sea. If somebody ever asks if you've been married before, try saying this. Oh yeah, I've been married so many times, I got rice marks on my face. But don't say that about anyone else. That's rude. That's a line I heard from Tom Waits a long time ago. He probably stole it from somebody else, maybe some vaudeville comic, some wino. Sometimes I type something up for the radio show and there's not enough time to tell that particular tale. Maybe it gets kicked down the block for another episode, and who knows if I ever actually used it. So this was something I thought I told a long time ago, but I have no record of ever saying it or typing it. One of the initial inspirations for this radio show was a Tom Waits interview I read in an alt-weekly newspaper 3 decades ago. I remember it pretty well. Although I can't remember if the weekly newspaper was in San Francisco or Sacramento. I was moving around in those days. On the road in the late great Golden State. So Tom Waits has these bits that he's doing for the press tour so the reporters aren't too annoying. They can't keep up because he's just rolling out these little stories, tall tales, routines. And one of them went something like this. He says, and I'm quoting incorrectly from memory. Oh, I've got a radio show now out in the desert in a little desert town. It's called Strange and Unusual Facts. And then he'd say some oddball factoid about lemurs or the height of Big Ben or how many legs a centipede has, which is variable, turns out. Then Tom Waits tells the music writer for the Alt Weekly, it's a small station and the signal doesn't get far, but people are enjoying the show and in fact, a number of people are moving to this desert town just to hear it. And that always sort of stuck with me. Because somewhere up ahead would be this radio show. in the little desert town of Joshua Tree. And you know what? I've had a number of people tell me in person to my face that they moved here because of this radio show. So, Tom, if you're out there tonight, thanks for the idea. See, I wanted to have people calling in like on Art Bell, but that time has passed. People have phones in their pockets night and day. But they are absolutely terrified of using those phones to make a phone call. And I don't blame them. Because cell phones are absolutely packed with little demons. Turn them off when you can. Hide them under an iron horseshoe. Amboitas, Isaacs, and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio broadcasting on KCDZ-FM in the high desert Friday nights at 10 p.m. Or listen on your little devil box, the phone, or on the computer. Preachers who were against good music used to call the fiddle the devil box. Years later, when I was a newspaper reporter, I had my dad's old micro cassette recorder that he'd use for memos. Then I got the label maker with the red tape and spelled out devil box and put that right there. I still have that thing, the Realistic brand from Radio Shack, and it still works. But it's not as convenient. I can't message myself with the memo like I can from the phone. And it doesn't do the auto transcript thing. Now, the auto-transcript thing doesn't work very well, but it works a lot better than nothing. And that's the promise of most technology. That's the promise of AI. It's not good, but sometimes it's a little better than nothing. As often happens, it got warm, and now it's chilly again. It's maybe gonna rain again. There's some snow in the Sierra again. And it's not a super bloom, sorry. Thanks to our patrons who support this radio show and podcast at DesertOracle.com and Patreon.com/DesertOracle. Please watch out if you're driving around in the desert. The creatures are out. The tortoises, the snakes, don't run them over. Give a hoot. And good night from the voice of the desert.
Maybe you can hear our local birds are getting pretty excited right now. There's a lot of bravado and wooing going on out there. Here it's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGBM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and streaming at kgbm.org. Next up, a show created by Ken Lane, April 15th, 2022. Here is Phantom Plane Crash on a Utah Highway.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
No. Night has fallen on the desert. This beautiful land that must tolerate so much from us. Like over in Utah, where all the small town streets are named according to the idea that nobody is ever going to leave their little town and maybe go over to the next one. Where the exact same baffling street names are used. As well as in the next town and the next town. And in every direction, the streets have the same names too. So you'll have North 100, South 100, East 100, West 100. So you drive in these square circles on various streets of the same name, which is 100. Not even Google Maps can make any sense of this. Which is why, when headed to a party a couple weeks back in Moab, I was originally directed by my worthless robot assistant to a corporate hotel event center instead of the outdoor space full of old hippies whooping it up and their nervous dogs underfoot. Most towns use a series of numbers and letters and maybe the names of U.S. states or dead presidents to give a sense of geographic place to the grid of streets where most people tend to live and work. Or in Palm Springs, for example, it's all dead entertainers. Gene Autry, Frank Sinatra, and one dead president who retired there after his 2 years of appointed service, Gerald Ford, the only U.S. president to demand a UFO task force in Congress. Ford was House Minority Leader back then when his office put out this press release on March 25, 1966. During the largest wave of UFO sightings in American history. Washington. House Minority Leader Gerald R. Ford, R. Michigan, today proposed that Congress investigate the rash of reported sightings of unidentified flying objects in southern Michigan and other parts of the country. Now that's a classic House district politician there, describing the whole of the United States as southern Michigan and other parts of the country. 3 days later, there was another press release. Quote, Ford is not satisfied with the Air Force explanation of the recent sightings in Michigan and describes the swamp gas version given by astrophysicist J. Allen Hynek as flippant. And this statement was attached to a letter from Ford stating that, quote, a UPI story out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, dated March 21, 1966, states that at least 40 persons, including 12 policemen, said today that they saw a strange flying object land in a swamp near here Sunday night, guarded by four sister ships. Quoting from the UPI story, Matt Sorrell of station WJR Detroit cites an eyewitness account of a recent UFO sighting by Emile Grenier of Ann Arbor, an aeronautical engineer employed by Ford Motor Company. He points out that an aeronautical engineer can hardly be considered an untrustworthy witness. John Fogerty wrote a Creedence Clearwater Revival song about these Midwestern UFO freakouts in the late 1960s. Let's see if I have the lyrics here to quote. Well, a crowd gathered round and a scientist said it was swamp gas.
Spiro came and made a speech about raising the Mars tax. The Vatican said, "Whoa, the Lord has come." Hollywood rushed out an epic film. And Ronnie the Popular said it was a communist plot. California Governor Ronald Reagan referenced in that last line, and Spiro was Spiro Agnew, who was vice president in 1969 when Creedence recorded this song. Agnew had to resign because of various crimes and to take the heat off Richard Nixon for a while, but not long enough, because that same Gerald Ford first replaced Spiro Agnew as vice president and then replaced Nixon himself as president. And all the while, the night skies were filled with brilliantly colored outrages, hovering silently at treetop level or chasing highway patrolmen down country back roads. What a time. Ultimately, it wasn't the UFOs or Watergate or even Vietnam that kept Gerald Ford from getting an elected full term as president. It was inflation. Even though he had these little lapel pins printed up that said WIN or whip inflation now, it just wasn't enough. You're listening to Desert Oracle Radio. With soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I love a desert highway that's so smooth and straight and lonesome that you can take the lid off your coffee and never spill a drop. Just sip it leisurely, listening to Philip Glass, Piano Concerto No. 3 on the Satellite Symphony Radio, coming out of Tonopah, knowing right where you're going to get lunch in Beatty. Snow on the mountains to the west, the great sagebrush valleys to the east. 55 degrees Fahrenheit on an early April morning. A land so large, so sparsely populated, that it just restores your whole faith in the world. And then you see the first solitary Joshua tree standing out there with its twin arms reaching out like a dowsing rod. Where two deserts meet, the Great Basin and the Great Mojave Wilderness, the middle of Nevada, home of my heart. I pick up an interesting station on the FM band, Weird Old Radio Dramas, and then Appalachian Music, a family group playing for a live audience somewhere, not around here, but that's the magic of radio. It's broadcasting from around here. The station identification comes around top of the hour, and it's Radio Goldfield, coming out of the next town on Highway 95. I look for the station studios and find them right there in the middle of the old mining town next to the Opera House and the Railroad Museum. There's somebody in the studio looking out the window that's looking out on US 95 making his 25 miles per hour cut through town. But the DJ is not moving. Because she's not alive.
You infinity of sunburnt sand and sagebrush, sweltering in 100,000 square miles of challenge. This, the state of Nevada, sixth largest in the Union, 48th in population. The few people in Nevada are creating in our United States a new frontier of opportunity. Nevada today is a place of up-to-date cities, offering the most modern improvements. The beginnings of industry, large-scale mechanized mining, a profitable agricultural enterprise, ingenious irrigation system, fine educational activity, and a hard-working progressive population, all challenging the future. Shaped like a native Paiute Indian tomahawk, Nevada is bounded by Oregon and Idaho to the north, Utah and Arizona to the west, and California to the east, with its Sierra Nevada range intercepting the rain winds from the Pacific and producing a most unusual climate for the sagebrush state. 320 days of dry, bright sunshine. Only 10 inches of rainfall. Yet here in the state of least water is successful agriculture. Nevada has the smallest number of farm and ranch operators in the nation, with only 6% of the land area under active cultivation. From sagebrush and sand, acres of oases. Ask a Nevada farmer how it's done, and he'll point to the nearest mountain slope. The Nevada water trick is worked with snow. Early each spring, the snow crop is tested for depth, water content, and probable runoff, channeled into reclamation projects for future harvest from melting snow flows into rivers, which are the most challenging on Earth, decreasing in flow when their water is most desperately needed. Many, with no outlet to the ocean, seep away, sink into the bottomless sand, and disappear in
Arizona, the land of sunshine and blue skies. Arizona, in area, is the fifth largest state in the Union, a sunlit expanse of cactus-covered desert and mesa, of mountain, plateau, valley, and canyon. In population, the state is one of the smallest, with only 750,000 people scattered over the endless miles. Arizona is the youngest state in the Union, the state of tomorrow, the second fastest growing of all these United States. She wears her adjectives well. Land of time enough and room enough. Land of big distances. The lonely land. Land of flaming rain. The cup of flaming burlap. Land of flaming sunsets. Land of contrasts. The Arizona story is the story of Nevada,
cursed as a nuisance by these early gold diggers,
and room enough. Land of blue sky, the lonely land, the colorful land. A land as young as tomorrow, the lonely land. A land as old as time.
Boom went Nevada. Railroad tracks laid, trains rolled to take out the treasure.
Here, time seems to stand still. The ancients tried to irrigate by the use of crude canals, but were unable to build proper dams, and their efforts failed. Arizona is proud of the four C's of her economy. Citrus, cotton, cattle, California copper, Casa Grande, Seminary, and carrots. Here, the first printing press was set up in grave markers, remind us of younger and more exciting days.
The graveyards of Nevada are full of men from all over the world who made rich strikes of ore in the turbulent past. In violence and in chance, the treasures of Nevada were tapped by adventurers who accepted all challenges. That's why 14 of Nevada's 17 counties make a large part of their income from poultry.
A land as old as time.
The local news comes on and I hear there are some people missing in the same general area I've been wandering around carelessly as always. And just like the person who disappeared overnight just outside Joshua Tree National Park a couple of weeks back, there just happened to be surveillance camera images of these people from the last place that they stopped. And I don't remember signing off on being part of a vast police state database simply because I ran into the mini market to get a cup of coffee. If I vanish in the wilderness, maybe that was the point. You never know what might happen on a long drive as I was turning off the 15 at Cedar City. I remembered something. Something strange about a guy driving through the same spot on the last day of February, 1959. He was an army private named Jerry Irwin, and he was driving back from Idaho where he'd been enjoying a few weeks' leave from his duties at Fort Bliss, down by El Paso. It was a dark night sky like you'd expect in southern Utah. And Private Irwin saw something so bright pass overhead that the whole landscape was fully illuminated. Whatever it was disappeared over a ridge, maybe the rim of Cedar Breaks National Monument. As Private Irwin was on Utah 14, 6 miles out of Cedar City, traveling southeast, he pulled off the road and started walking, somehow convinced it was a plane crash and that the passengers would need his help, if anyone survived. But before he wandered off into the night, he left a note on the dash. "Have gone to investigate possible plane crash. Please call law enforcement officers." And then to make sure somebody would stop, Irwin wrote "stop" in shoe polish on the side of the car in big letters. Sure enough, a half hour or so later, a fish and game officer saw the car and read the note. He raced down to Cedar City and got the sheriff, who sent a whole posse of people to search the area for a plane crash. Instead, they found Jerry Irwin, unconscious on the ground. They could not wake him up. So they got him to the hospital, where nobody else could revive him either. Well, he was alive and uninjured as far as anyone could tell, but he was asleep. When he finally came around, Private Irwin wanted to know what happened to the passengers. And where was his jacket? Wasn't it hanging off a bush where he left it at the site of the plane crash? The nurses and the doctors assured him there was no plane crash and no jacket. Sent back to Fort Bliss, Irwin spent a few days at the base hospital, but the doctors there could find nothing wrong with him either. So he was cleared to return to duty. Still, he could remember no details from the time he got out of his car to the time he woke up in the hospital. No details beyond his missing jacket and that supposed plane crash that lured him into the night. Then the fainting spells began. He fainted on base, fell into a deep sleep, but then he came out of it. A few days later, he passed out on the streets of El Paso. When he came out of it this time, it was as if the previous couple of weeks had never happened. Again, he wanted to know about the plane crash and his jacket. And this time he was put under the care of the psychiatrist. They watched him for weeks. But once again, everything seemed fine. The fainting spells had ended. And once again, Private Jerry Irwin returned to duty. He lasted just one day before going AWOL and turning up in Cedar City again on April 19, where he got off the bus and walked up the road 6 miles to where he'd first seen the strange vision and the darkened sky. He walked right out to where he was found the first time, and there was his jacket hanging on a bush. Stuck in the jacket's buttonholes was a pencil with a note wrapped tightly around it. Instead of reading it, Private Irwin had an unstoppable urge to burn the note, which he did right there. At this point, he came out of his trance and walked down to Cedar City, where he turned himself into the sheriff, the same sheriff who'd found him the first time. And who, having been there the first time around, explained to the baffled army private how this had all begun 6 weeks earlier. That summer, Irwin vanished again. For good this time, as the UFO legends have it. What became of Private Bernard G. Irwin? A researcher named David Boer decided to find out and found Irwin alive and living in his native Idaho in the year 2013. As for his experiences, Irwin still had no real recollection of what happened. But incidents of high strangeness had been part of his life since he was 3 years old. If his rambling recollections under an army psychiatrist's truth serum injection can be believed, what happened to this army private driving southeast from Cedar City back in the year 1959? Why did this Nike missile technician have such a singular encounter, and did his job have anything to do with it? David Boer, who put his new research into the book No Return, the Jerry Irwin story, brings all kinds of strange leads into the tale. Was the shadowy mind control operation MK Ultra involved? Unknown, although American researchers into the unexplained have often grabbed for sinister government connections. After all, this is America. How would Jerry Irwin respond had his experience occurred a couple thousand years ago? Say back in the days of the Trojan War, when the supernatural was natural, and omens lighted your way through a strange world. From Amboy, Detroit is Isaacs, and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. We broadcast on Friday nights at 10 p.m. from our home base at KCDZ 107.7 FM in Joshua Tree in the High Desert. And at various other times across the Southwest and beyond, on good community radio stations, including Fresno's KFCF 88.1 FM and Valley 103.9 up in King County, Washington, and our friends at KZMU FM in Moab and the Castle Valley. You know, time moves even when we don't. The real mystery years are the ones that just flew by while we did what exactly? That is a special kind of loss of the self. When years go by and you barely even notice. Because time quit working for you. There was a breakdown in the subjective personal narrative timeline. And then one day you snap out of it, hopefully. And then stare at the mirror for a long time. Is that you? Time goes on without you. Guess what's coming up in just 7.5 short years? 2030, that's what? The 2030s. And most of us are pretty unclear on whether or not the 2020s is something that already began. Just something to remember. Thanks for listening to the program. And good night from the voice of the desert.
Cedar Breaks National Monument is definitely on my camping wish list. Have you been there? A big thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver and to Ken Lane for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to all the volunteers, supporters, and underwriters that make KGVM so fabulous. Thanks to you for listening. Remember, April is National Poetry Month. Please share a favorite poem with us. Leave a text or voicemail for me at 406-404-6246. That number is finally working again, and I will get back to you. This program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are archived for you on the kgvm.org website. Watch those skies. Stay well. And keep doing good things and sweet dreams, and I'll see you next week. I leave you with this from Terry Tempest Williams. To acknowledge that which we cannot see, to give definition to that which we don't know, to create divine order out of chaos is the religious dance.